the J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, we'd better be on our best behaviour on this episode or we're sure to get red carded.
Yeah, well, Scott might have been given a three-match ban for some of his comments last week, especially from Arara fans. So, yeah, we'll keep it nice and clean and vanilla this week and, yeah, be on our best behaviour.
Indeed, we'll certainly do our best. So, yeah, it was a crazy weekend in the top flight with the five red cards shown. And here to hopefully help us make sense of it all, including a very upside-down looking table after two match days, is Sean Carroll. Sean, welcome back to the pod. It's great to have you with us for the first time in 2022.
Thanks for having me on. It's always good to follow Scott McIntyre. Yeah, I'll sure be a good palate cleanser for some of the listeners. I won't be coming in with quite so much contrarianism. I'll try my best anyway. Who knows?
Thank you very much for joining us, mate. Always a pleasure. And, well, yeah, big shoes to fill, no question. But, yes, yeah, couldn't think of a better man for the job. As we sink our teeth into J1 match day two played over the weekend. And, well, Sam, these are eight games that we saw on the weekend, of course, with FC Tokyo and Nagoya being idle after the COVID outbreak in the capital. Well, they did have some big acts to live up to, didn't they, after the two games in midweek that are both, I guess, at this stage of the proceedings, are front runners for games of the season. They were two absolute crackers, weren't they?
Oh, yeah, they're absolutely fantastic and worth me getting up at stupid o'clock in the morning on a Wednesday. Yeah, the Frontale-Marinos game was just end-to-end, great action, good intensity, good goals from both teams, Nakagawa's especially, and then Arara and Kobe had that to follow and they just came out of the blocks as well. It was a terrific few hours of football on a Wednesday morning and, yeah, if you're going to give me that, then you can do that every week.
Yes, that's right. And of course, the four ACL clubs will be in action again this Wednesday. So, yeah, Sam, you'll hopefully have another couple of crackers to look forward to. So, yes, one of the victors last Wednesday, in fact, the only victor, of course, the Reds and Kobe ended in a draw, was Yokohama F. Marinos. And to many of us, a surprising top-of-the-table clash that was the only J1 game played on Sunday at the Hitachi Dai after Kashiwa, of course, somewhat surprising winners in match day one away at Shonan, hosted F. Marinos, who had 4 points to show from their first two games. And, well, this was an interesting one, to put it mildly, Sean. Again, Kashiwa benefiting from an opponent getting a red card, and, in fact, two by the end of the game, of course. And, yes, they've made it two from two, and to almost everybody's surprise, are topping the table after match day two.
Yeah, I mean, it's very early to say topping the table. When you said about the table being upside down there, I thought, oh, is it? I hadn't noticed that. And I was like, oh, yeah, we're only two games in. So it's, yeah, it's a little bit hasty to be worrying too much about who's where in the rankings, I think. And yeah, for Reysol, I've only seen the highlights of their two games. So it's hard to gauge too much, too much of a deep insight into how they're playing. They have obviously benefited from their opponents getting players sent off in the first half of both. I think Shonan's player, I think he was sent off in the first half as well. So
yeah,
that does make a difference. I mean, yeah, obviously there are cases. Japan against Greece at the World Cup in 2004 springs immediately to mind. But there are cases, yeah, where playing against 10 men can become more difficult. But yeah, I think in this stage of the season where teams are not necessarily having to hold on for points, desperate points for their survival bids or whatever, I think teams are still pretty much trying to go for it. Yeah, we'll come on to the Shizuoka Derby in due course. But yeah, Jubilo as well, once they went down to 10 men, was still, they almost came out and were a bit more attacking, I felt, than when they had 11 men. So yeah, for Reysol, it's hard to get too much of a read. But yeah, no, none of us predicted that they'd be, I think most people in J-Pred, as you said on the pod, I think it was last week, maybe 2 weeks ago, when you did the breakdown of the percentages, yeah, a lot of people had them in the relegation scrap or even in the relegation places. So, yeah, to get out, to get 6 points on the board already, yeah, they're proving quite a lot of us wrong, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm still going to stick by my J-Pred at the moment. I mean, yeah, as you mentioned, the two red cards, the red card against Shonan in the first half, and then they kind of eventually got in on that with the penalty that kind of helped them out. And in this game, yeah, Yokohama got two red cards, but some of the play, and Eduardo, my good friend Eduardo, who was so good last season, and this year he was just like, he forgot that he'd moved to Yokohama and not Kashua. The sort of clearances that he was doing straight to the opposition, he got away with one before the first error, and then there was another one, him and Takeoka just passing it between themselves, causing so many problems. And Eduardo was the root of two of Kashua's goals, so not only are they getting the benefit of two red cards, but they're getting the benefit of some shambolic play at the back, and very uncharacteristic from Eduardo. Maybe he's not quite up to speed, not quite used to the way that they're trying to pass out from the back, but even so, it was quite basic things he was attempting and getting wrong. And yeah, Kashua, great for them that they've managed to benefit from that and get 6 points on the board. But yeah, I'm still waiting for them to have an actual fair 11 versus 11 test where they, yeah, they have to actually work a bit harder for their goals.
Well, yeah, that's good to hear you on the front foot there regarding Eduardo, Sam, because, yeah, I was obviously prepared to give him a decent serving. But, yeah, you've beaten me to it there. As you say, he was him and the keeper, Takeoka, were directly responsible for, yes, Kashiwa's first two goals. And I mean, I guess, Sam, coming back to you, I mean, it's easy to, yeah, to make the observation that, yes, they've played for over an hour in their first two games against 10 men, and then again F. Marino's finished this game with only 9, of course, after Tomoki Iwata was sent off late on. But by the time Shinosuke Hatanaka had been showed his second yellow card in the 35th minute, they had cancelled out another of your mate, Anderson Lopez's opener in the 5th minute. And well, yes, Eduardo again has to hold his hands up and is directly responsible there. But so, I mean, did that come completely against the run of play, the first Reysol goal? Because yeah, when F. Marinos did go down to 10 men, it was 1-1, and Reysol had fought their way back into the game, and they've gone on to win it. But were they decent value for yeah, being level by the time Hatanaka was sent off?
I don't think so. I think Marinos really started the better side, and obviously they deserved their goal. They got it quite early, and then Eduardo, as even before that first one, there was one where he tries to clear it in his 6-yard box and he boots it against Nagato and it falls to Savio, which produced like their first chance, Kashua. And most of their chances did just come from Yokohama giving the ball away or making ridiculous errors. And maybe you can, to a degree, credit the pressing that they did, Kashua, but I don't think it took anything special to cause these errors from Yokohama. So, yeah, I do think it was just Yokohama shooting themselves in the foot rather than anything Kashua did. And yeah, they found themselves, I thought, fortunate to be 1-1. But yeah, it's all Yokohama's fault, I suppose.
Yeah, now, Sean, you will have seen the game in the week. Obviously, the F. Marinos Kawasaki game was an absolute barn burner. And, well, yeah, for I guess for a lot of us, it appeared that F. Marinos had thrown a marker down. And, you know, people were starting to question, you know, Kawasaki and, you know, how they're going to fare this season after barely scraping past FC Tokyo in the opener. And then, yes, getting finding themselves on the end of a 4-2 hammering in the second game. And obviously we'll come on to them very shortly. But from an F. Marino's perspective, I mean, is this one that Kevin Muscat is just going to have to try and shrug off? I mean, we've mentioned Eduardo and Nagato a couple of times already, that two new defenders into the club, yeah, obviously thrust into the starting 11. So are these just, I guess, teething problems that those two players especially are going to have to get you know, work through as they settle themselves into this team?
Well, yeah, they are. I still think he's going to be bitterly disappointed that they messed up after beating Frontale. And yeah, they were obviously, they conceded at the last minute against Cerezo. I wrote a piece for Football Channel, as always happens. I wrote something talking about how well they'd started ahead of the Reysol game, and then obviously they lost. But yeah, in both of those first two games, they didn't only sort of get the 4 points, but they had, you know, more of the play, they had more of the more shots on goal, they looked very assertive, very aggressive again, and they were really sort of capitalizing upon the attacking, I mean, I hesitate to call it attacking talent, because yeah, Anderson Lopez is just an enigma to me, as well as he is to Sam. I don't understand how he does it. Teruhito Nakagawa as well is a player I don't particularly rate. He's very, very fast, and that's about it as far as I'm concerned. His end product is often really, really not up to scratch. But yeah, as happened in 2019, things seem to be really clicking for them in that game against Kawasaki, and by playing on the front foot, they were able to negate any issues they would have had at the back. I mean, obviously losing Thiago Martins is a big blow. Ogihara left as well. Obviously, was a pretty much played every game, I think, last year in defensive midfield. So that kind of structure obviously is going to take a bit of time. I do like Iwata when he moved into defensive midfield against Kawasaki. I thought they looked much better. They had much better control than when Kouta Watanabe was in there. He just looked a little bit off the pace. And I think after having beaten Kawasaki, yeah, Muscat is going to be very, very disappointed. Obviously, there's the caveat of the red cards and individual errors. But I mean, it's not as if Marinos didn't make individual errors in defence when Postecoglou was there in 2019. They still managed to ride out games and get enough goals at the other end. So I think Muscat will privately be very, very disappointed that they threw away that chance to really... again, it's way too early to talk about positions, but to extend that strong start they'd had into a third game.
All right, then. And Daniel H., one of our patrons, asks, have Kashiwa made fools out of all of us who put them in the J-Pred relegation dogfight, Sam? You said you're not wavering yourself, but I mean, the positives for Raysol, I mean, yes, they've won their two games. They've obviously had the benefits of red cards for their opponents in both games. But here, Mal Hosoya and Douglas, who we were worried last week he might have suffered a serious ankle injury, but he was fit to start here and got his first Raysol goal after Hosoya charged down a Takaoka clearance from an underhit Eduardo back pass. And then for the second week in a row, Tomiya Koyamatsu has come off the bench and put the icing on the cake here. So Raysol have won, I guess, a match day one relegation six-pointer, or at least, you know, two teams we expect to struggle this year against Shonan in match day one. And again, in inverted commas, they've won a top-of-the-table clash in match day two. So while they've been the beneficiaries of, yes, some officiating in their favour, they've done, you know, there's plenty of teams that in the similar situations, you know, don't go on to win those games. And they've won both by two goal margins. So yeah, Raysol have done all they can, I suppose, Sam, to this point.
Yeah, I mean, the old cliche, you only can beat what's in front of you, and you know, they have done that. And most positive things are Koyamatsu coming back to fitness. He's on the score sheet a couple of times. Douglas, I thought he could have been out for a lengthy amount of time the way he went off last week, but it's great for him to be back. And those two have to be firing if this team is going to be able to survive. I think they're the strongest attacking players in that team, and if you can get them working together, get them on the score sheet, get their confidence up, then yeah, they've got a great chance of doing that. There is still that talent, I suppose, in this team, and 6 points at this stage, it could be the difference at the end of the season. And so fair play to them for that. And yeah, I suppose they did take their chances, but it's still very difficult for me to look past. I think all three goals are Marinos mistakes, plus they went down to nine men, so I'm not going to get carried away too far with Kashiwa, but let their supporters do that. They're top of the league, so they might as well enjoy it.
Yes, none of us expected them to be this high, I guess, at any stage of the season, Sean. So, yeah, the fact that they've a perfect two wins from two. Yes, let's let the Raysol fans enjoy it. And just for the record, sorry, I don't have everybody's J-Preds memorised. Were Raysol in your bottom three, Sean, in your J-Pred?
Oh, God, I can't remember mine either. I think they were. I think they were. I definitely had Jubilo down there. And I think Raysol... Shonan, I think I might. No, did I go for Shonan maybe to just avoid it again? Yeah, it was tough sort of looking. I think with J-Preds, you know, you're always looking pretty much at, especially these days where so much of the preseason stuff is done behind closed doors. You really can't get much of a gauge on on how the new look teams are looking. So much of it is done based on how teams ended last year. So I think I probably did, looking through the table, I probably did plump for them to be there or thereabouts, yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. Again, the stats from Richie last week, there were 78 of us and 50 had Kashua in their bottom three. So there's a very good chance that, yes, you were one of the 50.
Yeah, I think there is.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And sorry, that was a pretty rough question without notice to throw at you.
That's fine. We should know, we should be more proud of our J-Preds. yeah, there's been so much football already. It's hard to keep up.
It's not your pinned tweet, Sean. I'm surprised to hear that. Fair enough.
It's not. Okay. I'm not even sure if I know how to pin a tweet.
All right. Well, we'll get our tech people in touch with yours, and then we'll get that sorted out for you. So yes, F. Marino's lost to Shinosuke Hatanaka in the 35th minute, and then Tomoki Iwata in the 87th. We've got a couple of questions from our patrons on the officiating over the weekend, Sam. So I guess we don't want to dawdle on these particular decisions too much, but I mean the Iwata one. It's one of those that looks really harsh, and it's VAR assisted. Is he the last man? Well, he might be if you draw a line across the pitch, but the Raisol player is 40, 45 yards from goal out near the right hand touchline. So, for me, that's a really tough one. And again, the clear and obvious error, stipulation to me, that doesn't really warrant, this particular decision, but again, we might have a first falling out of the season if you're all in favor of this.
Well, I think the clear and obvious error thing is something in writing only, because I don't think it's ever played out on the pitch, so as much as it should do. So I would agree with you on that basis. And I think there's also a tug from Hosoya to start with on Iwata, because he's quite a way behind him when they first goes and then does pull him back. Once it's then given as a foul, I think it is a red card once you go to it. I think he's going in on goal. I don't think there's anyone that's going to stop him, and he is going to get onto the ball. So I do think it was a red card, but I agree with you that I don't think it was a massive, clear and obvious error from the referee. But yeah, again, has that ever been a feature of this VAR as much as it should be?
Yes. Yeah. Well. Iwata obviously felt very hard done to, and F. Marinos finished the game with nine men, and two goals to the wrong, and well done to Raisol for topping the table after two match days, and it turns out that after Wednesday's 4-2 defeat at the hands of F. Marinos, rumours of Kawasaki's demise might have been ill-founded, Sean, as they shuffled their pack. Toru Uniki made a number of changes as they headed up to Kashima, who, of course, were in a fine fettle after their 3-1 away win over Gunma Osaka in match day one. This shaped as a very stern test of Frontale's mettle early on in the season, as I say, with a much changed side coming off a heavy defeat. But as champions do, and as they've done numerous times in the past four or five seasons, they went away from home, took an early lead, and saw off Antlers 2-0.
Yeah, they did. I think I'll sort of take a similar line to what I did with Reiso. I think in the J League in particular, teams go through spells of form, and you shouldn't rush to rash decisions. I think Kawasaki obviously lost the Super Cup against Reds. I think they were they were a bit unlucky. They conceded very, very early on in that game, and then Reds were able to sort of sit tight and defend the lead. They were maybe a bit surprised by how quickly Tokyo had gelled under their new manager in the first game, and were certainly fortunate not to go behind in that one, and then to snatch the win at the end was it's the cliche that it's the sort of the mark of champion teams when you're able to do that. The game against Marinos, I mean, it was, again, Marinos were excellent in that match, and they did score two goals in just over a minute to turn things around. Kawasaki were ahead, did pull one back. I think Marinos deserved to win on the balance of play, but yeah, I don't think a team that is as good as Kawasaki and has been as dominant for as long as they have now, they don't get thrown off course by one game. Obviously, coming up against Kashima next up was going to be a big test, and if they'd lost that as well, maybe then there might start to be some doubt come in. But yeah, Oniki has developed the style of play so well that, that whoever comes in knows what they're supposed to do. They were helped out by another terrible piece of defending by Sekigawa, who looks a bit like a rugby player and seemed like he was wearing rugby boots, I think, when he did that. I don't know what he was thinking. And yeah, once you gave them that advantage, Kawasaki then were able to slip into gear. They've got so many good players in the squad that, yeah, they were able to steady the ship. And obviously, they've still got games coming thick and fast with the midweek matches and stuff. But I think I did go for Kawasaki in my J-Pred to win it again. I just felt they would ultimately still probably have just enough. So, yeah, 6 points from the first two games is obviously not as emphatic as the way they were playing last year when they were going on 10, 11 game unbeaten runs. But yeah, I think they'll be happy enough with that. If they can get through the next couple of weeks with a couple more wins and a draw or two, I think they'll be pretty comfortable.
All right then. So it was Kei Chin-en who had come off the bench and scored against F Marinos in midweek, who made the most of his first start of the season and gave Frontale a second minute lead when, yes, the previously mentioned Ikuma Sekigawa basically passed the ball straight to him on the edge of the box in just the second minute. And yeah, Chin-en lashed a shot across Kwon-Soon Tae, and then first-year left-back Asahi Sasaki, who also came off the bench on Wednesday to make his J-League debut, was handed a first start of his career by Toru Uniki here and made it a day to remember by volleying in at the back post after a corner was headed on, putting the champions 2-0 up in the 17th minute. And from there, Sam, I guess they pretty much cruise to victory. Antlers were, looking, well, certainly a lot blunter than they did in the match day one away at Gumba. I mean, Yuta Higuchi skimmed the bar with a shot early in the second half, but Jung Sung-ryung wasn't really tested in the Frontale goal, as Sean said. Yeah, Kawasaki well and truly bounced back from Wednesday's disappointment.
Yeah, it's kind of a night and day performance from Kashima from last week. Even before Gamba went down to 10 men, their movement up front was really good. Their passing was crisp. They were always a threat and they were always testing Ishikawa. But yeah, this, I think maybe the early goal kind of put them on the back foot. And then defensively, they were a complete shambles, which is, I think, what we're going to come to expect for a lot of this season, Kashima, because all their eggs are in the attacking basket. And yeah, dreadful piece of play from Sekigawa. The defending from the corner to allow Sasaki to score was equally poor. And they were just all over the place for that first 45 minutes. And Kawasaki maybe would have thought they could have got two or three more actually in that first half. Wakizaka had quite a few chances. Chin-en had a good one that Constantine saved. So at that point, it was just all Kawasaki. And Kashima kind of wrestled it back a little bit in the second half, but Kawasaki were quite content to sit in on that 2-0 lead and were very rarely tested. As you mentioned, that Higuchi chance was the only real clear-cut opportunity that Kashima managed to create. And considering the defensive issues that Kawasaki have, Yamamura is still playing back there and Sasaki on his first start, I thought they dealt with that front four of Kashima very, very well. So yeah, it was great for Kawasaki fans to see their team back and playing in some sort of form compared to last season. But yeah, Kashima, it's just going to be one of those seasons, I think, where on their day they can blow anyone apart and on their worst day they can just fall apart.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, well said. So, a harsh lesson for Daiki Iwamasa. They're a stand-in manager, of course, while they wait for Rene Weiler to come into the country. So, Sam, let me just come back to you quickly. What about the Chanatip watch for this week? There's obviously been a lot of interest in the Thai superstar and his move to Todoroki from Sapporo, of course. He's appeared to be a square peg trying to fit into a round hole in the first couple of games. Was he any better here? Did he appear to be any more settled in than in the first couple of games as he hopefully makes a decent fist of forming a partnership with Wakizaka, Tachibana, of course, and Oshima and Schmidt, who will be floating around when they're both not injured?
Yeah, I think this is probably his best performance. I don't think he's still in the right position for him. He wants to be further forward, but that's just not how Kawasaki plays. So he is going to play deeper. But this time he got more involved. He got closer to the area. He seemed to work quite well, actually, with Chinen, more so than he has done with Damian so far. He got close to him. He had a few shots from the edge of the area, a few half chances, I suppose. So I don't think he's quite there yet, and it's still going to take a bit more time for him to really integrate into this system. But yeah, he's definitely more central. He's definitely trying to get closer to goal where he's more dangerous. So yeah, I think it's a nice gradual improvement from Chamatin.
All right. And Sean, I don't know why I remember this, but all those years ago when you used to write profiles of players for the J-League website, you did speak to Kazuya Yamamura, didn't you? I think that was when he was breaking through at Kashima, right? So now he's got a chance for an extended run in the Frontale team. I don't know. Do you keep tabs on him? Do you keep a close watch on him? I don't think he's in the boyfriend status for you, is he? the likes of his former teammate Kento Misao. But yeah, do you keep an eye on Yamamura these days?
Not that closely, but yeah, well remembered. He was the captain of the under 22, under 21 when they played in the what's it called, Asian Games. It was like the year or two before the Olympics in London. So the kind of big things were expected of him, and they picked him up, and he never really kicked on at Kashima. A couple of people I spoke to there said the main issue with him, like technically he was always really, really good, but they just said sort of mentally he didn't think he quite had what it took to push on to the next level. And yeah, I think that kind of pretty much sort of I think still shines through now. He's obviously a very capable football player, but yeah, I don't think he's definitely a downgrade. Well, most people would be a downgrade on Jesse, obviously, but yeah, I think there is maybe something that opposition teams can maybe can look at as a potential part of the Kawasaki team to target. Yeah, not a bad player, but in a team of excellent players, I think yeah, maybe he is a slight downgrade.
Yep, fair enough then. Yeah, I always remember that for some reason, and
You wondered why he interviewed him.
Oh no, well I remember. Yeah, he was the next big thing there for a while, wasn't he? But as you say, he just never quite kicked on, never quite made it. But yeah, still hanging around, and now got an extended chance, obviously, in the Frontale first team with not only Jezio but Kurumaya out as well. So Frontale, as I said, they're not dead and buried yet, listeners, as you probably all suspected all along. And yes, they're back in the top two in the table, as we expect them to be pretty much all season. A surprise occupant of the ACL places at the moment is Shimizu S-Pulse, who have claimed ownership of Shizuoka again. It was great to have the Shizuoka Derby back on the slate on Saturday. It was the early kickoff, I guess, the showpiece occasion, at least for half an hour until Cerezo and Kyoto kicked off. But yes, it did have top billing in the match day, and another eventful game, to put it mildly, Sam. Just like F. Marino's Iwata finished the game with nine men and with a nil pois after S-Pulse claimed a 2-1 victory.
Yeah, it did have pretty much everything. I mean, Jubilo, I was worried last week because they just sat so deep against Avispa. I thought every game that they're going to play is just going to be dull. But for whatever reason, they decided to go the other way and just press really high on the halfway line. It cost them almost immediately when Suzuki was allowed to wander through after Yamamoto. I don't know. He had a horrible game. There's some of the ways he was trying to press and just kind of nip in front of the centre forward and miss it completely. And it allowed Suzuki in to go and score. But Jubilo were high in their press. They were more attacking. They got back into the game at the end of that first half. And we might have an argument here on Suzuki's goal, because you'll probably say you meant it and I'll say you crossed it, but might get to that later. But I thought it was a really exciting game. Both teams went for it, and then Jubilo were cost by their couple of red cards. I think it's slightly unfortunate, the Yamamoto one, in that it's a late tackle, but he slips over and then he falls into the Shimizu man. I can't remember exactly who it was. So I think he was a little bit unlucky, but I can't defend Fabian Gonzalez. I don't know why he's decided to slap Suzuki. It just didn't seem to make any sense to me, but that's what he did. Jubilo went down to nine men, and it was just a little bit of a shambles from them, and it caused like a real, as Sean mentioned earlier, Jubilo did go really attacking despite going down to 10 and 9 men, and it caused like a ping pong effect of a game, and Shimizu had so many chances. My wonderful fantasy pickup of Suzuki scored, but should have had plenty more, but his teammates wasted chances to provide him assists. But yeah, it was a really good end-to-end and exciting derby. I still think it should have been played at the Yamaha Stadium, because you could have had a full stadium there and the atmosphere would have been much better than the kind of vast expanse of Ekopa. But other than that, I have no complaints about this game.
Yeah, it looked like an absolute cracker, but, well, extremely confusing, because a lot of the flashpoints in the game involved a player's named Suzuki, and I guess it's entirely appropriate, because the Suzuki Motor Company was founded in Hamamatsu in Shizuoka Prefecture, so the Shizuoka Derby was dominated by Suzuki's. As you say, Sam, Yuito Suzuki gave S-Pulse a ninth-minute lead when he was basically given the freedom of the Iwata half of the pitch, but then Yuto Suzuki slid in to meet a long ball over the top, and his shot arced over Shuichi Gonda and into the net in the 23rd minute. Then, with just over 20 minutes left, none of the Suzukis were involved as the S-Pulse went back in front, but it was another tremendous strike on the counter. Katsuhiro Nakayama received on the left, cut back onto his right foot, and arrowed a shot across Ryuki Miura and in. But, well, then, yes, it did all go to pot for Iwata at two red cards in the space of 4 minutes. Firstly, Norimichi Yamamoto, who did have an afternoon to forget, but was, a little bit harshly shown a second yellow card after he slipped into an S-Pulse player in the 74th minute. And then, Fabian Gonzalez smashed Yoshinori Suzuki in the face in the 78th minute, just 8 minutes after he'd come on. So, I guess he just didn't fancy it at all, Fabian, on Saturday. But, Sean, I mean, Sam and I talked about it a couple of times throughout the preseason. It never shaped as a classic, as the two teams that we don't expect to feature up the sharp end of the table. But for a derby with the two teams, obviously still feeling themselves out early on in the season, it did have pretty much everything, didn't it?
It did. I agree with Sam though. They should have played it at Yamaha. Each team should play it at home. I don't know what the deal is going to be when it's Shimizu's home fixture.
That Nihon Daira.
Okay, so I don't know why Jubilo gave up having home advantage, and it's much more compact stadium. I know obviously fans aren't allowed to sing and chant whatever, but I don't know why they decided to play it in that big concrete bowl. As a game it was good. I think I like Sam, I had Suzuki, the Yuito Suzuki in my team. I bought him in as one of my post-deadline chips when I saw that Yuki Kakita was out. So I was delighted when he scored straight away. But was livid when the rest of his teammates late on decided they couldn't be bothered to accept any of his assists and give me any more points. The first red card was a joke. It was never. He slipped over. I don't know what the rules are with VAR, if they're not allowed to intervene if it's a second yellow. But he slipped over. He didn't mean to foul the player. Obviously he did take him out, but he slipped on the turf, so that was a ridiculous decision. And the second red was just a ridiculous decision by Gonzalez. I have no idea what he was thinking, waving his arm around like that. But it was a decent game, good entertainment again. Nice for like an early afternoon to get everyone warmed up for the games that were going to come. It was good. And the derbies doesn't matter, does it, if the teams are going to be challenging for the title or not. It's always nice when there's very few actual derbies in Japan. I mean, hardly any really when you think about it. So to have two teams that have got an actual rivalry is always enjoyable. So fingers crossed that the next time they meet at Nihon Daira, we have a similar entertainment.
I don't know if either of you can confirm this, but was this the referee's first J-League game? I think I read that on Twitter somewhere, and he's been given the Shizuoka Derby and dished out two red cards. I mean, fair play to him for not hanging back, I suppose.
I don't know either. Alex Bishop did message and say that he'd read that somewhere too. So I don't know. I can't say for sure. if it was. But I mean, if it was, good on him. Get in there. I'm all for it. Yeah, get in the mix and show you're not to be messed with. Why not? Why not? If you're given a big fixture like that as your first game, you might as well step up to the plate.
Yes, I must admit, Koe Koya is a name I'm not familiar with. But yes, if he keeps dishing out red cards at this rate,
if it was Koya, yeah, that's not his first game by any stretch of the imagination. He's been around a long time.
Oh, right, yeah, okay. That's...
So yeah, if that was, in fact, he manages or he did manage a women's futsal team because I was covering a women's futsal tournament up in Sendai a few years ago. And I asked him a question in the press conference afterwards about whether he felt more pressure managing the girls or being out on the pitch in a J-League match. So that's why I know the name. So, yeah, he is definitely not a newbie. So I don't know where that fact would have come up from. Maybe someone said it looked like it was his first game. But, yeah, most definitely wasn't.
Okay. Well, there we go. Thank you, Sean, for putting that to that vicious rumor to bed.
But, yeah, still,
I'll definitely be keeping an eye on him in future match days anyway. As if he's this card happy, then never a dull moment, it appears, with Mr. Koya. Espol's, again, it's far too early, but why not? We haven't got anything else to overreact to, have we, listeners? So Espol's third in the table after two match days. But if that sounds familiar to their supporters, well, that's because basically this time last season after match day two, they were fourth with the same record, a win and a draw from their first two. Of course, they went away to Antlers on the first day of the season last year and shocked the world. And from there it was very much a gradual slide down the table. So they will hope to perhaps build a little bit of momentum up in the top half of the table early on this season. And obviously we're not going to be able to kill the buzz for Espol supporters, no matter what we say on this episode, because they have taken control of their prefecture on Saturday afternoon at the Ikopa Stadium. So another team that is feeling very happy, I would say, at the moment are Gumba Osaka, who bounced back after the previously mentioned 3-1 home defeat they suffered at the hands of Kashima last weekend by travelling up to Urawa and, basically piling on the agony for Ricardo Rodriguez's side, who are really struggling here after two match days. But of course, they've played three games and are yet to win this season. So I said in the intro, the table is very topsy-turvy at the moment. Of course, that's because Kashiwa are top, Espol's are third, and as we're going to come on to shortly, Kyoto are fourth. But also at the wrong end of the table, wrong in inverted commas, Kobe and Reds find themselves in the bottom five with no wins from their first three games of the season. So let's talk about Reds first then, Sean. They obviously were, it appeared, cruising to victory at home against Kobe on Wednesday before a rush of blood from Takahiro Akimoto and his straight red card basically turned the tide of that game. And then, of course, the man, the myth, the legend, Tomoaki Makino, went on to equalize for Vissel against his former club late on. And, things just aren't going for them at the moment, are they? There was another red card here, this time for Ken Iwao, a second yellow card in the last 10 minutes. And after that, not directly as a result of that, I would argue, but almost straight after that, Gumba Osaka went and scored the only goal of the game through Yuya Fukuda.
Yeah, I'd probably go on a similar line that I had with Kawasaki. I think, the results haven't fallen for them, but they dominated this one. They should have. They had so many chances. I mean, if Kasper Juncker was on the pitch, I would think they'd have at least four, if not 6 points so far, maybe even more. So the Kobe game, as you said, conceding right at the end after an idiotic sending off swung the momentum away from them. They missed so many chances against Gamba, and then you lose the guy who's holding the the team together in the middle of the park. And yeah, I agree, it probably wasn't a direct result of the sending off, but it doesn't help losing a player who provides that balance in that position, because that's pretty much where the goal came from. And yeah, I mean, the first day of the season away to Kyoto's first game back up, first day of the season, you never know. You said just there that Shimizu beat Kashima away last year. You know, you get these freak results, and it was only a 1-0. So yeah, it's there's those fine margins. And as I said, the Kawasaki have been able to ride them out and still have 6 points. Reds haven't been able to ride them out, and at the moment they've only got the one. But I certainly wouldn't take quite as harsh a line as last week's caller. I don't think that the manager's a fraud and the players are not up to it. But I do think, yeah, there was probably an element of overexcitement ahead of the season from some after they won the Super Cup. I think it was still going to be a tough order for them to challenge Kawasaki this season. Rodriguez, it took him 4 years to get Tokushima promoted from J2, and they were never, even then, they were never a dominant team. They were always a good side. They always played some nice stuff, but they always lacked a little bit of edge in front of goal. So yeah, it's a case of getting the he's still sort of tinkering with the lineup a bit, whether because of injuries and COVID or whether because he's just not quite sure what his best lineup is. But you know, if you're going to win the league, you need three or four players in key positions who are playing above average, you know, a higher level every single week. And at the moment, Reds, you've probably got players in that squad that have the ability to do that, but at the minute they're not. Juncker, I assume he must have picked up COVID or something, because he was put up for the preseason media duties when the J League did their ahead of the first game. He was put up for Reds, and I asked him if he was fit, and he said he felt he was fit and ready for the first game, if not definitely the second one. Mm. And I think I'm right in saying he's not even been on the bench so far. So you'd have to assume that there's been some kind of injury. As Scott suggested last week, there's stuff going on behind the scenes. I'd just be surprised if the club would have put him up as the guy for the media opportunities when there's plenty of other players that could have done it. So yeah, time will tell on that front. But yeah, if you can get Juncker in the team playing every week, if Iwao can not get sent off and put a run together in the middle of the park, Alexander Schultz looks like an excellent defender. I'm not really sold on Iwanami. I've never really understood what it is he does. He seems to play all the time, regardless of who the manager is. And he's not a bad player by any means, but he's never really stood out for me. And they've got about 17 excellent attacking midfielders. If Rodriguez can work out which three or four of them are his best ones and put them out on the pitch every week if fit, and then yeah, there's definitely potential in that team. But yeah, so far things haven't quite clicked for them. But I don't think it's time to start panicking just yet.
No, I think these have been two games. The last two games have been games that Urara have dominated until the red card. They've just kind of not had that cutting edge. I think in this game they really missed Akimoto. I mean, obviously sent off last week, but there was nobody really to stretch Gamba the other way. Asaka does want to drop deep, and Koizumi kind of almost wants to play in the same position as Asaka, but without an Akimoto to go the other way, or you've got Juncker who could do the same. Matsuo is also we haven't seen. So, yeah, they are missing, I think, key elements to the way that Rodriguez wants to play. But, yeah, I mean, defensively, I share your point on Iwanami. I think he's a little bit slow in his decision-making. I think he's a little bit of a risk when he's in possession as well. I think there's just something not quite on with him. I think Inukai is there, and I would go with Inukai and Schultz as the centre-back pairing at Red, so maybe that will work its way into being the case later in the season. But yeah, it's just, they're a decent, like, it's not time to panic for Reds. I think they, yeah, controlled most of this game, and once they get back to everyone being fit, obviously the COVID issues have harmed, they haven't been able to put a settled side out for the first three games. So yeah, it's not great for them, these results, but I think it will improve. And it's still a Reds team that have signed so many new players over this winter. I thought that it would take a little bit of time for them to gel, and that Super Cup, it looked like everything had happened and it had all been perfect and it had all worked out so quickly. But I think it's right that this is going to happen, and you're going to have a little bit of a teething period for Red Sen at the start of this season. But going on to Gamba, I mean, it's great for them to have got 3 points on the on their books. They obviously struggled against Kashmir. The red card didn't help them, and they were on the back foot for a lot of it in this game as well. But for them to just get back up and running, because last season they got into that funk, didn't they, where obviously didn't play too many games, but then they started losing a lot of games, got themselves into that danger area. This one, it kind of keeps them above water a bit, and it's a nice thing to build on, even though, yeah, I don't think they particularly played that well.
Yeah, I mean, from what I saw, Reds dominated the chances. And, well, again, it's a terrific performance from Kei Ishikawa in the Gumba goal, filling in for Masaaki Higashiguchi. Again, he didn't do a lot wrong with conceding 3 goals last week against the Antlers. But, yeah, was very busy here away at Reds. And I don't know. Well, yeah, we thought we had a goalkeeping controversy at the Gumba with Higashiguchi and Tani. Maybe it's Higashiguchi and Ishikawa, and maybe Tani can just stay at Shonan or go to Europe or whatever he wants to do, because Ishikawa has proven to be a very capable stand-in in the first two match days. And yes, his teammates were sure to go over and celebrate with him at the full-time whistle, as they appreciated the role he had played in their first victory of the season. And yeah, terrific scenes on the touchline as well, with the first victory of the Tomohiro Katanosaka era notched. So, yeah, frustration for Reds, no question. But again, they're betting in a lot of new players. And, yes, obviously some big ones to come back as well. Kasper Juncker, their frontline striker. And, yes, their major attacking signing of the winter, Yusuke Matsuo. We hope we'll see both of them sooner rather than later, as, yeah, Sean says, to add to their embarrassment of riches in attacking areas. Okay, so correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but I believe that's all of the five red cards from the weekend covered. So the two for Yokohama F. Marinos, then the two for Iwata, and then Ken Iwao sent off for Urawa. So we did have a couple of questions from our patrons. Mike S. Wants to know our thoughts on, well, all the cards and sending offs so far. Is it trigger happy refs? Is it a VAR abuse? A welcome increase in physicality, or internationally relevant level of simulation, as Scott talked about last week? Mike says he's sure it's a little bit of this, a little bit of that, but curious to hear our analysis. So yeah, I don't know. Is this this sweeping the J League, Sean? Are these this plethora of red cards, or is it more a number of isolated incidents that'll just sort themselves out gradually?
I think it's hard to look at all of them as one mass. I mean, you get this sometimes, often at the start of seasons. And I actually did some proper research when you sent that question over early on. I did look, because I know that the JFA do kind of referee and briefings and stuff ahead of the season, and I remembered seeing they were doing one this year, and I looked up what they talked about. They called it the refereeing standard for this season, and they singled out some things, some different themes that they were looking at to kind of, you know, get the referees focused on. One of them was I don't know how you'd translate it. Just basically acts that endanger the safety of other players on the pitch. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things they wanted to look at. So they showed a video of some incidents from last year, including like the Leandro one against Nagoya and stuff like that. And they said that that's one of the issues they told refs to make sure they're making the right decisions to clamp down on. So I think it's like anything, you know, all of us have our jobs, and there's times where suddenly your boss gets a bee in their bonnet about something, and then for a short time afterwards, whether consciously or un, you're focusing on that. You're making sure that you're doing a good job focusing on that. We see it often with leagues around the world that a new rule comes in, or a new interpretation of a rule, and referees focus on it, and then it gradually gets pared back. So I think maybe there's a slight element of of referees overreacting, but I mean, Akimoto should have been sent off. Iwao, I only saw the highlights, so I don't know what he got his first yellow for, but it looked like a second yellow to me. Same for Hatanaka. Iwata, yeah, it was questionable. The first one for Jubilo was not. He slipped. Fabian Gonzalez, he hits the guy in the face. He hits Suzuki in the face, so it's a red. I mean, you know, it's, yeah, I think there's an element of referees definitely maybe being a little bit keen to show that they're taking this new guideline seriously, and it might well level off a bit over the coming weeks. But I also think, yeah, there's most of the sendings off look, you know, they don't look like majorly incorrect decisions. So yeah, I think if we're still seeing this many in a month or so, then perhaps, yeah, it is a deeper rooted issue. But for now, I don't think it's worth reading too much into.
Mike challenged us to high level thinking, so I can't promise that, but I'll give it a go. I don't think you can legislate for the Akimoto red card, the Suzuki red card, or the Fabian Gonzalez one. It's just kind of either acts of complete stupidity from the two players or play acting from Suzuki. But the other ones, just generally in the J-League this year, I think we've lost a lot of the Ficadenti type managers, Lotina, Jofuku. Everyone has kind of bought into this counter-press, high-press system, and a lot of the red cards have been as a result of teams pushing high up the pitch and either being caught out in behind, as you got for Oiwa for Shonan last week and you got for Iwata this week, or you've got the midfielders just kind of counter-pressing, and it's so many quick turnovers of possession and players get themselves kind of caught out. But I think that was where Iwao got his two bookings from. It's just from him being a bit too kind of enthusiastic in his pressing, let's say, and quite poor tackles. Yamamoto the same. Even though he slips on the second one, it's because he's trying to rush out and press his man, and that's where he got his two yellow cards as well. And I think that was just kind of the same in a lot of these instances. It's just teams like maybe in some instances not used to being able to play this system and not being as disciplined as you have to be in this, and just being really over-enthusiastic in the pressing, and it's causing stupid fouls, it's causing yellow cards, because they're often just build-ups of that. So I think that is an issue that they're going to have a little bit at the start of the season as teams kind of get used to this. I think the games are going to be a bit more frenetic with those turnovers in midfield that are going to introduce a few more late tackles in there. So I think it might play out and I might be talking complete nonsense, but that's kind of my gut reaction to the first couple of weeks.
No, I think, yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think it's that hopefully ties in with the referees too, that you've got the players obviously are keen to show their managers that they're willing to do what's being asked of them, but maybe they're not quite up to speed with how to do it yet, which, as you said, is then causing these kind of rash challenges or stuff. And I think maybe referees, you know, we don't want to see second yellow cards if it's not really, really dangerous play. And I think, you know, by the letter of the law, I think, yeah, certainly Iwao's, I think, probably should have been a second yellow. But you know, if the referees are being given guidelines to stamp down on any play that is dangerous, they're going to want to make sure that they do that to please their bosses, rather than be like, well, we don't want to, you know, you don't want to send him off. And I'm hoping it will balance out, where the referees kind of realize too, well, maybe take him aside. They could have taken him aside, had a word and said, look, you're already on a yellow. I probably should give you another one for that, but just calm yourself down, or the next one is going to have to be a red. And you'd like to think there's some common sense during this briefing that they did for the referees. They said, you know, the whole point is that the referees want to be part of making the games enjoyable and entertaining. And obviously stamping down on violent play is a way to make sure the games are still entertaining. But on the flip side, you ideally you want to have 11v11. You want teams to be at full strength to face each other. So if they can maybe kind of try to lay off on the second yellows a bit, whether that is just with their in-game management, whether it's by going into the change rooms before games, talking to the clubs and saying, look, we don't want to have to do this, so meet us halfway. But yeah, I do feel like it's start of the season. Everyone is, players, coaches, fans, referees, they're all out there and eager to get going. And I think, yeah, maybe once the excitement and the adrenaline wears off a bit and we get into the things get returned to kind of normal, then I think maybe, yeah, it will all kind of level out a bit.
Yes, very well said by the pair of you there. And, yeah, terrific response. to Mike's question. I'm sure Mike will be very pleased with that. Along similar lines, Johnny Nicol asks, do you expect the spate of red cards seen over the first week of the season to be a trend that continues, or will things return to normal soon? I guess, Johnny, if players stop smashing each other in the neck or face area, then hopefully things will even themselves out. Akimoto and Gonzalez obviously auditioning for the WWE over the course of the last week. So there's violent play, and then as Sam and Sean point out, there's late tackles and somewhat unfortunate, I suppose, red cards where the intent is to try and win the ball, but if you're a little bit late, then again, there's if you commit to a tackle, then there's obviously a risk of catching the man instead, and a couple of players have found that out to their detriment in the past week. But obviously, they have they've been varied, haven't they? The red cards over the first two match days, on the break, or obviously with the missed time tackles, or just plain violent conduct. So, it's given us plenty to talk about. On this episode, and we'll be obviously keeping an eye on things in the next couple of weeks. We'll move off those two questions, and thanks again to Mike and Johnny for them. And we'll carry on then with the other four games that are left to review, and they were all drawn in match day two. Following on from Reds, while they've been frustrated in their first three games, we're not pushing the panic button with Urawa yet to win. Presumably, the guys are in a similar boat in regards to Kobe, who, as I mentioned earlier, are in the bottom five after they've played the three games, and most of the rest of the league have only played two. For Vissel, they had to make do with a 0-0 home draw against Fukuoka on Saturday afternoon in what was Tomoaki Makino's 400th J1 appearance. Of course, he was the hero for Vissel in his 399th when he netted the late equaliser against Urawa. The Fukuoka goalkeeper, Masaki Murakami, was the busier of the two custodians, but that's mainly because Avispa striker Lukian couldn't hit a barn door. He failed to trouble Daiya Maikawa with a myriad of second-half chances, as the visitors actually finished the stronger here. So a point away from home against an ACL opponent is a good result, Sam, but they will have left feeling frustrated, I reckon, that they didn't get more from the game.
Yeah, they had a lot of pressure, especially in that second half. As you said, they were the better side, I thought. They kind of had Vissel captain that half for a lot of it. Generally, the angle of attack is fairly similar for Avispa. All they do is go wide, they cross it in. They're looking for Lukian to make something of it. He's not really up to speed, I don't think, in the first two games, and nobody else is really helping him out in that respect going forward. And Vissel didn't really deal with it. It was just like, it crosses into the box, but the finishing touch just wasn't there for Avispa, and they didn't really figure out a different way of attacking Vissel. They just kind of kept doing the same thing and the same thing. And I suppose if you're winning the headers in the box, then you're thinking, okay, we're doing the right stuff. But Maikawa really had very little to do. So it's disappointing in some aspects for Avispa, but great for them to have been able to control at least a second half against a team like Vissel, and there are things that they can work on. But for Vissel, I thought it was a really disappointing performance. Probably out of all of the top teams that have had disappointing starts, I think this is probably the overall worst performance, at least this week. And probably Vissel in general have had the worst performances with the way they played against Nagoya last week. So they didn't get too much going. They had a couple of chances where I think Sasaki probably had the best one, but went wide. And just Osaka and Muto, they just didn't really get into the game for whatever reason. And you'd have thought with Iniesta coming back into the team, it would really open up avenues for them to go down the side or play intricate passes. But Avispa, to their credit, defended very well, as they did all of last season.
Yes, indeed. So, Sean, you're not pushing any panic buttons for Kobe yet? I mean, they, yeah, this was a game, obviously, they would have hoped to really kickstart their season after, yes, the loss at Nagoya last week. And then, well, you're having to come from behind against a Reds team that finished with 10 men to earn a draw in midweek. So this was this shaped as a potential season kicker-offerer. But, yeah, it just never really happened for them, did it?
You should get that on a T-shirt, season kicker offerer. I like that. I think there's more, not panic buttons, but I haven't really been impressed with Kobe. I expected more from them coming into the season. I really felt like, yeah, they'd signed a couple of solid. I mean, Makino has been on the wane for a couple of years. He's been a bit of a liability for Reds defensively. His positioning, I lost count of the amount of times you'd see him kind of grimacing in one of his kind of, ready-made for camera reactions after they've conceded when he was 2 or 3 yards in out of position. That happened quite a lot. So I do think he's on the wane, but at the same time, he's got enough about him in the J League to come in and I think, yeah, do at least cover for Thomas Vermaelen, who never really looked that good for Kobe, I didn't think. Ogihara as well came in, another solid J Leaguer, won the league not so long ago with Marinos, another solid dependable player. So I felt like, yeah, they kind of finally had the pieces in place to make a challenge, at least a steady challenge. They ended last year very well as well, and they haven't really. I mean, Ogihara, yeah, another one to get a red card early on, which hasn't helped him or Kobe. But yeah, whereas Reds have been playing reasonably well and making chances and not taking them, Kobe just still look like they don't really look like a team. I don't know if the issue is the manager or what it is, but the amount of good players they've got, it still seems like they just feel like, well, you know, there's loads of famous players here. If we put them out on the pitch, it will be all right. I've got Muto in my fantasy team and I'm livid at him for missing that penalty and then afterwards scoring a sort of physics defying goal. And he's missed a couple of other chances. Him and Osako don't really look like a strike partnership. It just looks like a couple of bolt-on famous players that they picked up. They're not, neither of them really look comfortable yet in the final third. So yeah, it's not panic buttons, but I haven't really seen many sprouts there that make you think, yeah, that this is a team that looks like they're going to be challenging. I mean, yeah, Marinos obviously lost against Racel, but the first couple of performances were good. Reds haven't been picking up the points, but they've been playing in at least a coherent style that you can see what they're trying to do. Kawasaki too, and Kobe so far, yeah, still hasn't really clicked. They look more like the Kobe we've seen up until, I'd say, the last four or five months of last season, when they started to look like they might actually be turning into something. Now they seem to have reverted to the Kobe we knew before that are just, yeah, they're just not quite there. I mean, Avispa, yeah, it was a away game and Avispa were dominating. It was, as the clock was counting down, they looked like they were the home team. They were going for the win. And yeah, unfortunately, they couldn't take any of their chances. But if I was a Kobe fan or if I was Andres Iniesta, I'd be a little bit worried that, you know, How are we at home against a team that, all right, Avispa did very, very well last year and they are they're a solid team. But, you know, that's the kind of a opponent that I think Kobe, with all the money they've spent and the everything in place at the club, they shouldn't be the ones with their backs to the wall as the clock's counting down in that kind of fixture.
So it sounds like, yeah, we're a little bit more worried than Kobe. About Kobe rather than Reds, who obviously are sorting out a lot of new personnel and obviously have a lot of key players to come back. Whereas at Kobe, I think they've added to the fringes and we kind of thought they were pretty much already the finished article. So, yeah, the fact they haven't won any of their first three is very frustrating for their supporters, I'm sure. And, it doesn't get any easier for them on Wednesday because they have to travel up to Kanagawa to face Yokohama F. Marinos. So that will be a very interesting game, no question at all. But yeah, more on Avispa, who obviously, yeah, following on from their terrific 2021 with a really positive result here. And yes, Daniel H is back with another question. And one of these days I'll convince Daniel to come on board as our Fukuoka correspondent. But yeah, watch this space, listeners. Daniel says that, yes, Avispa have drawn their last six league games, with three of those being 0-0. So, Sam, what do they need to do to convert those draws into wins? Is it just a matter of Lukian hitting some form? For me, it's just a matter of Lukian hitting the target.
Yeah, that would definitely help. Definitely an improvement because, yeah, first two games, he's not really looked like the striker that scored 20-odd goals in J2 last season. But in his defence, I would say that a lot of their, in both games, it's just been get the ball wide, cross it in and hope he does something with it. And he's obviously got the ability to do that and he should be doing better. But I think they could benefit from mixing it up a little bit if it's just playing it into his feet and having Yamagishi work off him, or Crew and Kanemori from either side, and just work it a little bit like that. Or maybe just take a shot from the edge of the area, do something that the defence isn't expecting, because both defences have been able to, Kobe and Jubilo this year, and then to an extent last season as well. If you just sit in against Avispa, they're just going to cross it. It's going to be fairly easy to defend if you're a competent defence, and Jubilo managed to do that last week for the majority of it. And Kobe, although finishing was a bit poor from Avispa, they still managed to come away fairly comfortable without their goalkeeper being tested. So, yeah, I just think mix it up a little bit, maybe be a little bit quicker, because it's just a bit slow and predictable, I think, the way that they build up at the moment. So they just need to be a bit more inventive, a bit quicker, and then maybe they might get some rewards. But that being said, for them to have dominated Kobe for a good 45 minutes, I think there are still lots of positives to take from that.
Yes, indeed. No question at all. So, yeah, good point away from home for Fukuoka. But yes, the lingering feeling that it could have been more. All right. So, yeah, three games to go. And yeah, hands up if you had Kyoto as the highest placed Kansai team after match day two. Well, that is what has eventuated, listeners. They followed up their opening day win at home against Reds by claiming another point, this time in a 1-1 draw away at Cerezo Osaka. And the visitors, Sanga, took the lead in the 34th minute when Hisashi Apia headed Temba Matsuda's corner down into the ground and off the bar, with Kosuke Taketomi, Johnny, on the spot to nod in the rebound from 2 yards out. At either end of the pitch, Peter Utaka and Takashi Inui drew smart saves in the last 10 minutes of the first half, and then Inui grabbed the equaliser 3 minutes into the second half, sliding in to meet Hiroshi Kiyotake's pass to finish past Naoto Kami Fukumoto. And then in the last 10 minutes, it was indeed the Kami Fukumoto show. He twice flung himself to his left to make terrific saves from Kiyotake and the substitute Bruno Mendes. And then deep into stoppage time. Oh, goodness gracious me, what a scene this was. Exciting Cerezo sub Sota Kitano actually blocked a deep free kick that Kyoto had hoped to pump into the box, and then was sent racing away. He took the ball past the last defender and bore down on the keeper. Kitano looked certain to score, but Kami Fukumoto stuck out a leg and somehow saved Sanga again. An incredible ending as the visitors just about hung on. So, Sean, you will have watched a lot of Kyoto last season in J2. Scott said last week that, yeah, their match day one performance was actually not very indicative of what got them promoted in the first place. But I guess a lot of it will have been, backs to the wall performance like this was here in the last 10 or 15 minutes when they really had to hang on and had their keeper to thank for leaving with a point.
I've only seen the highlights of their two games so far, so I don't know exactly how the full 90 minutes have played out. But I mean, yeah, Chalky J, you know, with a Chalky J team, that the players are going to work. They're going to work hard. He's a big fan of German football and pressing football, and I've spoken to players who've played under him, and some of them are huge fans of that style, and some of them just don't like the fact they have to work so hard all the time. They find it exhausting. But yeah, the players that that he likes know exactly what's expected of them, and they're willing to do it for the 90 minutes. So yeah, we know that Mr. McIntyre is a purist of the game and wants teams to play one way and one way only. Not sometimes Chalky J teams do that. They do play with an attacking mindset. Other times they're happy to just work hard, press the opponents, and hope they can break. And I think I think a lot of people out of them and Jubilo predicted that Kyoto would be better placed to stay up this year. I don't think many expected them to start quite so well as they've done in terms of points. But yeah, they've got a lot of good technical football players in there as well. In the middle of the park, in particular, Kawasaki, Fukuoka, Temba Matsuda, Taketomi obviously has been around a while. He needs to get rid of that ridiculous mustache. But aside from that, there's good players there. They were obviously bailed out at the end, as you said. Kitano will be devastated. I'm not going to forget that miss for a while. It was a decent save, I suppose, but you need to be putting those away. A solid start from what I'd say is a solid team, and I think they'll be quite happy to continue throughout the season with a kind of a win one, lose one, draw one approach. See if they can stay up this year and then look to build on that over the coming years. They'll be more than happy, I think.
Yeah, I thought Kyoto played fairly well. I don't think they had as many attacking opportunities this week than they did last week. They didn't really press as high up the pitch and cause the errors. Maybe they were just playing against Urawa, so they knew that they're going to take a few more risks and word from that. This was a bit more set in, and they had a lot to thank their goalkeeper for. So I thought Cerezo were the better side. They got through quite a few times. I thought Nakahara, the right winger that they've got, has come in this season. I thought he was very exciting getting to the byline. It's sort of, I don't want to put too much pressure on him, but he looked a little bit Sakamoto-esque in the way that he was playing a few times this week. The one he got to the byline, pulled it back for an Inui shot. I thought that was a terrific little run from Nakahara, so hopefully he can build on that. But generally speaking, yes, Cerezo caused the most, had the most chances, caused Kyoto a few problems. Kiyotake and Inanui's movement and balls through to each other, it worked for the goal, and they had other bits of link up where Kami Fukumoto just bailed Kyoto out. I mean, he looking a pretty decent fantasy pickup at the moment, the amount of saves he's making. But you've got to give credit to Kyoto for the way that they worked so hard, as was said earlier. I mean, they really just kind of... Just non-stop aggression and pressing and trying to work hard for the team. It's not necessarily the prettiest style of football, but it was effective. They've got themselves 4 points from the first two games, so credit to them. But yeah, I thought Cerezo were the better side and were a little unfortunate to not come away with a win.
Yeah, well, a very entertaining Kansai derby between Cerezo and Kyoto. And yes, the points were shared as they were up at the Sapporo Dome with a friend of the podcast, Graham McKenzie, watching on from the stands. Consadole and their visitors, Sanfrecce Hiroshima, fought out a one-all draw for the hosts. Shinzo Kuroki swept home his first Sapporo goal with a neat first-time finish in the 11th minute. I'm not sure if Akito Fukumori was credited with an assist in the fantasy game or not, Sam. It looked like the ball was taken off his bootstraps as he was shaping to shoot. So we'll need to get the adjudication team onto that one. But a first Consadole goal for Kuroki. And after Tsukasa Morishima had hit the post for the visitors shortly before halftime, he made no mistake 9 minutes after the break, stroking home sweetly past Takanori Sugino from inside the D to equalise. There are a couple of chances at either end after the equaliser. And shortly after, Daiki Suga's low drive squirmed under Takato Hayashi, but came back off the post, and Yoshifumi Kashiwa cleared for the visitors. And then in stoppage time, Hiroshima had a decent chance to win it, but Shunki Higashi's First time shot went wide of Sugano's goal. So, well, I don't know, guys. Yeah, this is one of a game between two teams who at best will be in mired in the mid-table mediocrity this season. And in fact, well, that's where they sit after two match days. Consadole and Sapporo, Consadole and Hiroshima both have 2 points after two draws and sit 10th and 11th in the table. So, I don't know, if there's no objection, I mean, yeah, the supporters of these two teams probably won't like it too much, but I don't know if there's a massive amount we need to cover from this game. So why don't we just plow on and get to the final game of the match day that also finished 1-1. This was down in Kyushu with Tosu hosting Shonan. And Sam, I wanted to spend a little bit more time on this game because I want you to tell me everything you know about the young Tosu striker Yuta Fujihara. He came off the bench in second half stoppage time last week to make his J1 debut, but obviously no time to really make an impact. But he did start and score in the Levain Cup in midweek. He was handed his first J1 start here and volleyed in the opener for the hosts in the 24th minute. So, yes, what's the dossier on Fujihara?
Fairly empty, to be quite honest with you. I mean, Tosu made a lot of these signings in the winter, a lot of young players, a lot of university players, all that sort of thing. So it's one of the things I have to do in every winter is try and figure out who these players are, because I don't watch any of the high school championships or anything like that. I really don't have an insight into university football. So I'm there just trying to find, OK, what has he done? Has he got any awards anywhere? Has he played at youth level anywhere? Has he played Japan under 17s or anything? And he was just one of those players where there's nothing about him that I could find. I'm sure it is somewhere if I knew where to look better, but yeah, it was a complete unknown to me coming into this season. And then he announced himself in midweek with the Levain Cup, because I generally dislike that competition, but it does give you a chance to see these players and give these players time, and they prove what they can do. And Fujihara, I thought his movement in from that centre forward position is terrific. It's very intelligent, the way he can find space. And then you saw with his goal here, his touch and finish was terrific. So he does look a very good prospect. I don't know where he was hiding previously, but yeah, great little pickup by the sounds of it for Sagan Tosu. And Yuki Kakuta will be ruining the fact that he's missed this game, because I think his golden boot run is under threat now, from Fujihara.
Yes, you snooze, you lose. And yeah, it looks like Fujihara is the man of the moment now for Tosu. So it's pretty harsh on Kakita, but there you go. He had his chance and now he appears to have lost it. And well, talking of chances, Sean, as I try to segue Tosu should have been over the hills and far away by the time Shonan got their equaliser. But, it's another moment of a Park Il-gyu madness, isn't it? Of course, he'd conceded two basically empty net chances from 35 yards to Hiroshima players last week. They were unable to capitalise. But, yes, a heavy touch on the edge of his own box in the 68th minute. A Shonan player pounced and Shuto Machino strode through and stroked the ball into an empty net. So, you know, I mean, there's frustration for the likes of Kobe, you know, a performance that didn't go their way. But I mean, when you're totally in control of a game, as Tosu were here, and as I say, could have been three or four goals to the good, for your keeper to then basically throw one in his own net is it's a really, really tough one to take.
Well, it is, but I mean, that's the approach that Kinta Kawai wants the team to play. Obviously, that's what Park did when he was at Marinos too. I think he was it the last game of the season against Tokyo. Did he get a red card in that game? Was he way out of his box?
Yeah, that's right.
So I mean, that is what he does. He's obviously tasked with almost being that sort of sweeper keeper, coming out and becoming an extra outfielder, which then allows the outfield players to push up a bit further and play the style of football they want. So I mean, I don't think the manager can have been too upset with the goalkeeper, because I assume that, you know, that they're the instructions that he was given him to play with. So yeah, as you said, it happened in the previous game too, and the opposition players weren't able to take advantage of it. Whether you change the whole approach of how you want the team to play because of that then comes down to what the manager wants to do, you know. I remember when Juan Schneider was at Jeff and they had Yuya Sato in goal, and it was like every week, you know, he'd be 40 yards out from goal trying to play like Franz Beckenbauer. He'd lose the ball and then they'd concede, and it was like, it did get to a point when you're thinking, well, surely the coach is going to have to try and rethink this, because it's not just the odd error that's creeping in, it's every week they're getting caught out and it's costing them so many points. And Snyder never did seem to want to change the approach. So yeah, I think it comes down to what the manager themselves want to do. And again, if you can take enough of your chances at the other end, it should still even out, and you should still be getting enough points. I always prefer teams to play with a more attacking mindset. You know, it's much more exciting, I think, for neutral fans and for fans of the team itself, that, you know, you'd rather win 4-3 than 1-0, I think. So it's just getting that balance. So I don't think the manager will be too angry about that. Obviously part will be wanting to limit the mistakes and the chances he gives the opponents, but if that's the job he's been given, then I assume he'll keep trying to play out from the back and stick to the tactics of his manager.
Yeah, maybe he wants to check his boots as well, Park. Maybe he was wearing rugby boots on Saturday afternoon. Yeah, contributed to that heavy
maybe
touch.
Maybe he's got the same supplier as a Sekigawa up Sekigawa, in Kashima.
Yeah,
we'll have to see, yeah.
Exactly. Yes. Never a dull moment with Park Il-gyu, as we've come to realise over the past few seasons. And, Shonan, I guess, are thankful for anything they can get these days. Obviously, they were inconvenienced by the red card last week against Kashiwa and lost 2-0 at home, and didn't really appear to be in this game at all, but have ultimately left Kyushu with a point after this 1-1 draw. So yes, as we said at the start of the episode, with Tokyo and Nagoya idle, that is all of the 8 games from the weekend covered then. So all that's left is for us to look ahead to the next week in J1 with, as we mentioned earlier, 2 games coming up on Wednesday, the 4 ACL clubs in action. And again, they shape as a couple of crackers. Kawasaki host Urawa and Yokohama F. Marinos entertain Kobe. Both of the visitors on Wednesday night are still looking for their first victories of the season. So, plenty on the line in those games. Then on the weekend in match day 3, there's just the 1 top flight game on Saturday. And as most J1 games do, it shapes as an interesting one as the 2 promoted teams meet, with Iwata visiting the Sanga Stadium to face Kyoto at 2 p.m. And listeners, I can let you in. I can let you know that I have actually been in touch with Nick Bolton, and no promises. But firstly, it's good to know that Nick is alive. And secondly, that, if things go to plan, we might be able to catch up with Nick on next week's episode. But again, yes, no promises there, but certainly hoping to do that. Then on Sunday, Nagoya and FC Tokyo return to J1 action after having this weekend off due to the COVID outbreak in the capital. Grampus host Tosu at 2 o'clock, and Tokyo are away at Cerezo Osaka at 4 o'clock. But I wouldn't imagine that either of those 2 games would feature in your pick of the weekend, Sam. So I think I did neglect to ask you last week, and maybe, just blinded by Scott's numerous opinions and hot takes. So, what's your pick of the match day 3 slate?
Nagoya second toss, it could be a fairly interesting game. Nagoya played very well the first time they played, so we'll see how they get on again. But I think the game I will pick is Kashima versus Kashiwa. Obviously, top of the table, Kashiwa, can they continue that run? And what sort of team Kashima are going to put out? Because I think whatever happens with Kashima, they're going to be exciting to watch for one reason or another. Might be terrible reasons for them, as it was this weekend. But yeah, I think those 2 is just going to be... Yeah, every Anthers game is going to be open, and I think Kashiwa are buoyed by 6 points already. I think that would be a really good clash.
Yep, sounds like a good one. And, I guess, Sean, if the 2 visitors on Wednesday night fail to win again, Reds and to Kobe. I guess there'll be a little bit of extra pressure on their games on Sunday. I mean, Reds host Shawnan at 3 o'clock on Sunday, and that looks like a home banker. But obviously, Reds have struggled in that regard so far this year. And Kobe head to Hiroshima at 4 o'clock. So yes, we said we're not pushing any panic buttons yet. But if there's another couple of games without a win for both of these two teams, then if not now, then when?
Yeah, I think that's right. My eyes were drawn to those two fixtures, and I remember they played in midweek too. But yeah, if they don't win in midweek, then yeah, four games in without wins and two, as you said, winnable fixtures on paper. So it'd be interesting to see. Obviously, we don't know what's going to happen in midweek yet. We're recording Monday night, so for all we know, Reds are going to beat Kawasaki 5-0 away, and Kobe are going to do the same away to Marinos. You never know. But yeah, I think those fixtures, yeah, absolutely. Irrespective of what happens in midweek, Reds and Kobe will both be looking at those fixtures as ones they should be taking 3 points from. So if they don't, it's certainly, especially if Kawasaki do win in midweek again and win at the weekend, they'll already be on 12 points. If Reds and Kobe are already by that point 8-9 points behind them, it's still incredibly early in the season. But with the way Kawasaki have been over the past few years, they just don't drop that many points. It already leaves you with quite a hefty margin to make up. So yeah, those two games as well will certainly be worth keeping an eye on.
There's always something about Arara hosting Shonan as well. There was that ghost goal a couple of seasons ago.
Yep.
Whatever happened with Suzuki last year, and it had to be a 3-0 defeat for Reds. So yeah, tune in for that. I'm sure Okamoto will get an offside through VAR. That usually happens as well. So yeah, there's always something with that game. So yeah, that's a good pick.
Yeah, that's very well spotted, Sam. Yeah, that's never a dull moment. You're exactly right. And we'll wait and see. If Reds do fail to win on Wednesday night, the pressure will be definitely cranked up to 100 on Sunday. All right. So that's just about it for our review of a match day two. And look ahead to the weekend's match day three slate. So, we'll leave it there, Sean. It was absolutely terrific to catch up with you for the first time this season. Yes, and we obviously hope to do so numerous times throughout the year. So take it easy, mate. And yes, we'll hope to catch up again soon.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Hopefully speak to you soon, mate.
All right, then. And Sam, yes, terrific stuff. Again, great to hear from Sean again. And I'm sure you're looking forward very much to, not so much to the early morning, but yeah, definitely to the two games on Wednesday. As we said, a hard act to follow from last midweek, but they do shape as a couple of crackers, don't they?
Yes, yeah, should be terrific games. It's a 10 a.m. kickoff, the first one. That's more than fine with me. I've got to get used to them playing at the same time again and trying to get my notes on. But it's good preparation for when all 8 or 9 kick off at the same time in a few weeks' time. So, yeah, that'll be up for patrons some point Wednesday evening.
Yes, that's right. Of course, it's not a national holiday this Wednesday, is it? So, yes, in the evening kickoffs and the much more manageable for you over in the UK. All right. Well, yes, something for our patrons to look forward to in midweek. Speaking of them, thanks very much to Mike S., to Johnny, and to Daniel H. for their questions on this week's episode. And thanks to all of our patrons for their ongoing support. If you'd like to get involved, please visit patreon.com/JTalkPod. All right, that's it for this week's episode of the JTalk podcast. Sam and I would like to thank Sean Carroll very much for his time, our patrons again for their support, and to you listeners, thanks as always for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up J1 Match Day 3. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The JTalk podcast. Yes.